Fearscape Media Network, exploring the unknown, one podcast at a time.
Fearscape Paranormal Podcast, part of the Fearscape Media Network. Prepare to be spooked. New episodes every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms. Find out more at fearscapepodcast.com.
Welcome, everybody, to the next episode of Unsensitive, a show where we take a subject, talk about it with an expert, and break it down with questions that are normally too impolite to ask. I am your host, Ray Robinson, and today we will be talking about the stigma surrounding mental illness and finding out what might be apparent to some, might not be as apparent to somebody that is quite frankly really stable like myself. So joining us today will be in the hot seat today is JP Levengood. JP, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very
now,
much.
Now, let's go ahead and kind of launch right into to the first question that I've got, and that is it a bad idea to call you crazy?
Really not. I've called myself that. When I speak publicly, I like the word mad. I like to go old school with it. I just think it has a certain romance. Terms in the mental health community are really interesting. Some people are very sensitive. Other people are a bit nonchalant. I am a middle-aged man who went to Catholic school and have been living with this for my entire life. So crazy is just like, that's just the tip of the eye. It's like, oh, get out of here. You know, I've heard worse.
That's mild.
You know, you run two ways. You can be either a diagnosis or a genre, or, you know, I like to eventually just be me. But with your lead in talking about destigmatizing, it's like you don't want to stigmatize it and be too weird about it. And you also don't, I think we have this problem right now, trivializing mental illness, where everyone's like, oh, my OCD is acting up, or I'm a little ADD today. And I'm like, really? You know, have you crapped your pants because you forgot you had to go to the bathroom? Or have you rubbed your fingers till they've bled? You know, and I get that everything's on a spectrum and we all have small traits. But sometimes I think the problem with that language is when you encounter someone who is what we would call clinical in a depression or an ADD or an OCD or, you know, one of these neural abnormalities, is that atypicalness, is that people are like, oh, I know what depressed is like, and why can't you get over that? Or, oh, you know, I know what it's like to be flighty. You just need some more discipline. And, you know, so it's a weird thing. It's like at one point, any depressed person is going to be accused for any mass shooting in the country. It's the only time the United States cares about mental illness is to protect guns. And suddenly it's like, oh, mental illness. And then this other way, it's like when we actually need that funding that we're so adamant about during national tragedy, you know, then when it comes to talking about funding, it's like, well, you know, it's just depression. It's just, you know, just get over it. So it's a real oscillation nowadays. I don't see as much stigmatism, you know, where, you know, when I talk to people or I say, you know, I've been clinically depressed and I have, you know, pretty high level of ADHD, where people are like, oh my God, you know, should you be Hannibal Lectered up? But at the same time, there's a misunderstanding and there's an eggshell. And especially when you're in close relation, either work relation or, you know, some sort of professional relation or, you know, personal relation, there's this feeling that if you set my depression off, I'm just going to go to the nearest, you know, rope store, which is not, you know, that's much of that is on my place. But at the same time, you just can't be cold about it and be like, oh, come on, get up. It's weird with stigmatism and with the latest trivialization.
Gotcha. Okay.
What I use for people out there to kind of understand is think of your life as three bookshelves. And you got stuff that's on your shelf, stuff that's on their shelf, and a shelf we share. And mental illness, you're always trying to figure out what about this is mine and what about this needs to be negotiated with whoever I'm in this situation with.
Now, one of the things that often comes up, especially when you're talking about the ones that I hear the most, because I'm related to a Vietnam veteran, is folks that are homeless, former veterans. Maybe they've suffered some form of PTSD. Maybe they've got some form of undiagnosed mental illness. Is there any way to like determine what the percentage of those folks are that that should be getting that kind of help, the mental illness end of things?
One of my things is that you cannot differentiate between mental health and health. It's health. And I'm tired of mental health coverage being put in a silo, or, you know, there's times in my life where it was a third party provider where I had really good medical hospital doctor insurance, but then I would have to go to a third party provider, perhaps named after a world explorer, and just be getting this huge rigmarole. Yeah, mental health is health. Community health is health. Mental, physical, and community health really cannot be separated. But the problem is that we have spent the last at least 40, if not 50 to 60 years, criminalizing poverty, having a criminal approach to poverty. A large part of poverty is access to health programs. I mean, we're at a breaking point in this country about access to care. And it really aggravates me because I've because of the nature of depression and undiagnosed ADHD, I've had times of plenty and times of nil. So I've been in both private practice getting help, and I have been subject to public health, especially for, you know, someone that is, we're dealing with multiple problems here. We're dealing with a neurological, psychological, emotional issue, probably some addiction, some chemical dependency. And then in order to get the help they need, if they do qualify for their help, you have to go into a system that requires incredible patience, incredible stick-to-itiveness, incredible emotional regulation, standing in those lines, going through the paperwork. They're going to mess it up the first time. You go back, you appeal. And I've sat in that room with those people from a place of privilege, both from the way I've been raised and the resources and friends I have, and certain just innate abilities I can't really take credit for, just kind of born with. And, you know, I look in those waiting rooms, I'm like, at least 50% of the people waiting here trying to get care don't have the tools necessary to be heard and get access to the system. They're going to get frustrated. They're going to get turned away. They're going to get emotional, and they're going to get kicked out, or they're going to leave. They're just going to get frustrated and leave. You know, so many countries are showing the way that it is long-term more economically feasible to give people some type of stable living situation and access to treatment than it is to just throw money piecemeal at these programs. But the United States doesn't really like to deal with anything until it's immediately in their face on fire, or, you know, the base, that's it. You know, it's got to be broken or way on fire. We're not at that point yet with public health in general in this country, but we are really damn close. We're at an inflection point in this country and in this young democracy, and we're gonna see a lot of these things come to bear, unfortunately, in a way that we could have spent the last 50 years dealing with in a lot better, but we haven't. So the vet issue, it just kills me the way we prop these people up at national sporting events or political rallies, but then, you know, we're stepping over them on the street on the way to our lunch break. People have enough mental problems. You put mental problems in a war zone. How do you expect that to look? You know, it's like, it's insane. I have some very relatively sane, neurotypical people, friends of mine that have served in combat zones and have served in the green zone. And it took them years to get, you know, stop looking at everyone coming on the sidewalk with them in a friend or foe analysis situation, you know, right, reaching for sidearms that aren't there. So that's someone that's was fairly neurotypical going in and fairly neurotypical going out. And they still have PTSD and rewiring the brain, because that's what military training is. It's rewiring your brain. It's making you more aggressive.
Now, getting back to the programs themselves, you mentioned the difficulty it is to get on them, to stay on them. There's two questions really that I have in regards to that. Does it feel like the system is designed that way to weed people out? And my other question, and I'm going to throw this out before I forget it, really, is how typical would you say that somebody's kind of faking it just to get benefits so they don't have to work?
I'm going to address the first and then go back to the second. The faking it to get benefits thing. One, there's a mean way to get benefits in this country. You don't have to have them. And actually getting a mental disability to actually get on some type of Social Security income for a mental disability is hard as hell. It really is. As someone who's considered it a couple times, I was just like, it's not worth it. It's actually easier for me to get benefits when my mental illness creates a period of financial unhealth, you know, and it's much easier for me to, basically it's much easier for me to apply for benefits when I'm kind of financially unstable than mentally unstable. Because, you know, with Medicaid or EBT or anything like that, they just look at an income level. Yes, you qualify, boom, you're on. You know, Social Security benefits are just, it takes a lot. And especially things like ADHD and depression, the threshold for it is so disabilitating. There's something called ADLs, activities of daily living. And you have to lose so many of those ADLs to really, in my opinion, and someone out there maybe pulling out their hair that's actually a benefits manager, but it just seems like you have to lose so many ADLs that that's not the lived experience of someone trying to make rent and working part-time. And that's part of our problem with the benefits in this country is that we have a binary on and off switch. And I think we would have a lot better success if it was a graduated program where we slowly brought people on and off. There are times where people who are dealing with things, maybe you can deal with 50% a part-time job, 50% life. And maybe that's where you are for a year, but we don't do that, you know? So it's like, it seems like it's an all or nothing to me as just a layman on the street. So you almost have to collapse to get benefits to get back up. And, you know, it kills me even in work, the Leave Act. You're in a 3-week or 4-week program. You have, say, a depressive episode. You know, you go in inpatient for about 14 days, and you might be in some intensive outpatient for 14 to 21 days, and maybe then just a little bit of just weekly therapy. But at that point, your benefits manager and various laws are saying, okay, you're out, get back to it. You know, and it's just like, and a lot of people have very nice bosses and programs that work with that. But a lot of people, especially if you're in a larger kind of soulless corporation or assembly line, it's like, well, you know, you're done. You're out of rehab. Get back on the line. It's like, it's going to take a little time. I don't think that's as bad. And also, I don't think that we write laws in this country for the least common denominator. And this is the problem I really have, is that we always bring out these small percentage, under 10% of bad actors. And there's bad actors at the bottom, and there's bad actors at the top, okay? I would say there's more bad actors at the top looking at current tax revenue of American corporations, personally. If we write laws to catch the lowest common denominator, the lowest, really kind of, when you look at trillions of dollars of budget, the really insignificant level of fraud at the bottom, you're going to leave out a lot of people, you know? And you always try to improve the system, but you don't scrap the entire thing because there's always going to be people at the top or the bottom that are going to want to find a loophole. And you can't control that in society. You can't. We tend to really drag those people out. Ronald Reagan's welfare mother, you know, all these, we just drag them out as this is the experience of social programs in this country. And it's not. The fact is your next door neighbor that you don't even know, maybe on food stamps or some sort of Medicaid, you know, is you have no idea. Yeah. We were masquerading in a middle-class neighborhood with government cheese in our refrigerator when I was a kid. So you just don't know. You know, I was at a private Catholic grade school in a middle-class neighborhood, but we were having problems making ends meet because my stepfather was laid off. So yeah, we had government cheese and man, I miss it. It's good. The peanut butter, not so much, very dry. But so that's that issue. I hate putting that, you know, there. I don't think the system intentionally is there to weed people out. I think what the problem is that the system's overwhelmed. Most people, even if they're not really great, they really do have good intentions in public health because no one's in it for the money. But the problem is on their end, you know, they look at you as like, well, if you miss an appointment, you got to get back in line and get back into the system to get another appointment because that hour you didn't show up, there were 20 people on the waiting list. I get that. But then it also has a thing, the problem, there needs to be a way to catch and triage those people because it's not an, once again, it's not an on-off proposition. Some people are going to just slowly staccato get back, and we need a way to capture and tend to these people that are going to be intermittent about their therapy appointments, that are going to be intermittent. You know, we can't put them through the system. When they come in, there's got to be something for them, you know? We can't make them go through the whole rigmarole again. Man, I'm using rigmarole a lot today. But we can't have them go through all that again because of efficiencies, because those are the people we truly miss, the ones that are going to be only shooting about 33% on their appointments and stuff like that. You also, it's where the system lacks empathy. And I know a lot of these counselors have it within themselves, but the system doesn't have empathy, is for that one individual to get on that bus or to walk or to, you know, they missed their last appointment, but damn it, this is hurting and they want to fix it. And they go through all this stuff and they go through those doors, which are never pleasant doors, into that waiting room, which is never a great waiting room. And they come up and I missed my appointment, but I really need to see someone. Well, and you need to, you know, come back on Thursday during open hour, you know, and so you just give them a whole nother line of things. And so I'm in private care, and my doctor just recently retired. I don't think I had anything to do with this one. But anyway, but a private practice, when my ongoing 2.5 year relation, 3 year relationship, 3.5 year relationship with this doctor ended, they made me go back around, back around to the new patient line. And I'm like, you can't just give me a list of three people that accept my insurance here and just say which one. And there's no, you're making me go all, now I'm used to battling bureaucracy. It's part of mental health in this country, unfortunately. So I'm like, okay. And actually I told the person, I was like, I had a 20%, 30% feeling this was going to happen. I already have a doctor friend of mine on backup for any prescription that I might miss in this transition period. Mm-hmm. And they were almost offended by that. Fact is, if I had relied on them, I would have missed my refill because it's a controlled narcotic. So they can't just, and I was like, I know how this works more than you do. You've been working at this desk for 6 years. I have been crazy for 38, you know? So it's, I know this gig better than most. And so it's just, and like I said, I don't think it's purposeful on the system, because the fact is how do we distribute 36 hours of counseling time to a demand of 360 hours? You know, there's probably 10 people waiting to get treatment for every one person in the program. And unless you have insurance, unless you can skip into a line, and even then with insurance, the waits are incredible in this country. I mean, it almost, and it's costing us more money, because it's almost like if you have crisis, you almost have to go into the emergency room. You almost have to just be flat useless. But if you are like, man, I am two bad days away from having a really bad day, we don't have that. We do not have that in the United States. You know, one time I really knew I knew needed intensive outpatient. Now, in my life, I kind of know my level. So when I was seeking an intensive outpatient program, I was still a week or two away from crisis, and you know, serious crisis. I just wasn't getting anything done. I was just sitting and drooling a lot. And I'm like, this isn't good. You know, I had private insurance, I had a corporate job, and had discussed it with my bosses, called the provider, a residential intensive outpatient facility here in Louisville, Kentucky. I was put on a week waiting list. Now they got me in within a week, about, I think, a week and a day. And, you know, they said, if things get really bad, go to an emergency room. We can't wait for crisis. And I think that's part, feeds into the stigma that some of the people we see on the news being bad actors, one, you know, there's a lot more to it than just mental health. A lot of that is white male rage. Just looking at the stats, it's also a gun problem. It's also a lot of problems. But when we see, just to take the mental health portion out of that picture, we've allowed these people to get to crisis. You know, how many chances of intervention up to those points, up to the points of being displaced from stable housing, how many points from losing a job, how many points from involving in self or other abuse. I mean, how many points did we have to intervene to that point? We're a nation that I said at the top and I'll say at the bottom. We try to approach poverty by criminalizing it. And then all we have is a criminal police approach to fixing it. So it's just, we wait for crisis. the United States has been waiting for crisis for a long time. And guess what? Looks like it's on its way. So good job. And that's bipartisan, by the way. I mean, several people have taken a swing. I realize the huge mess that the Affordable Care Act was in and all the political powers that be. So I don't lay it at the foot of any particular person, except maybe the voters in Boston. But in Massachusetts. But really, you can't replace Ted Kennedy with someone's going to vote for healthcare. But anyway, the Affordable Care Act did very little. It did a lot for different other pre-existing conditions. It allowed me no longer to get turned down by insurance because I took medication for mental illness. But as far as actually bringing mental health into the health silo and just making it health, it didn't do much for that. And that's what is probably the most needed thing right now as far as our healthcare system as it exists, is that we get rid of the adjectives before the words health. It is health, and we need to approach it as such. So,
okay. Now let's kind of take a different approach here. We had talked about the people that we run across on the street. I want to kind of delve more into just when somebody finds out that they're working with somebody that has a mental health issue. A health issue.
I like to call it neuroatypicalness.
Okay, we'll go with that. The typical response is to be concerned for your own safety. Is there any kind of percentage that you could think of how many folks that have a mental health type of condition that it could get scary, it could get dicey for somebody in the normal work environment?
Well, the one, I mean, I would say, and I'm truly speaking on my rear end on this and just experience, but the people that you're going to encounter in the workplace are not generally the types of neural atypicalness that really lend itself to spontaneous violent behaviors. I mean, okay. I don't really see a paranoid schizophrenic passing a job interview. It's just within a half hour conversation, that's going to come up. So the people you meet, and that's the thing, and this is the thing where the school shooting and the stigma happens, is that your standard depressive anxiety, I mean, those tend to be functioning. You know, there are certain levels of paranoia that can function in the workplace. There's, you know, we're finding out a lot more autism can actually function in the workplace and probably has for years. We just haven't noticed it. We just call them science nerds because once again, everything's a spectrum. But for the most part, functional people that can pass a job interview and in the workplace are going to be far, 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 far more likely to hurt themselves than anybody else. Because mental illness, it can create a very selfish place. The lack of empathy to truly do harm to someone else, that falls on these, you know, sociopathy and the psychopathy. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot deeper. You're really not going to, I mean, a true psychopath in the American workplace, you're not going to find in the, on the assembly line, you're going to find in the chairman of the board's office at this point, really. You shouldn't be worried, you know, and it's just two things. Don't minimalize it like, oh yeah, no, sometimes I have that. Or sometimes it's nice if someone just ends it like, oh, you know, my mom, my brother, my sister, really dealt with that. And, you know, good job on you for being out here and doing what you're doing. If you're having a bad, you know, especially in a management position, if you're having a bad day, let me know and we can talk it out. But yeah, there's not a lot of reason for concern. You know, it's when you go to managers, and I've had a few good managers that are just like, you know, I really struggle at times with depression or attention. And I know that's mostly on me. You know, they make them, you know, like, okay, it's like diabetes. If you're not managing it, then we see you like actively not managing it. We're going to have a talk. But if you are, you know, given it an 80% shot of managing it, just like most diabetics, you know, they're 80% good and you have some bad days, you've got to take your sugar. You know, we've all had a coworker. It's like, oh man, for whatever reason, their sugar got out of control that day. We're not like, oh, you asshole, you can't, you know, did you take your pill? It's just like, okay, have a good day. Now, if they are not doing great maintenance and this is becoming a 3-time-a-week ritual, it's like, well, you either need to get better treatment or you need to manage your treatment a little bit better. But this is, you know, our shelf, your shelf, our shelf. This is becoming much more of an our shelf thing.
Right.
And, you know, that's just the way you deal with it. But it's just a health issue. And people should be, you know, relatively cool with it. What I hate is, you know, the double-edged sword isn't really people being fearful. It's then people wanting to put everything on your diagnosis. So, you know, if I'm depressed, it's like, oh, if I'm having just a bad day, say I'm just sad because of things that should make me sad, or I am pissed off, or I'm just having a day just because I am a human and I have those days. You know, people are like, oh, are you taking your medicine? Or, you know, it's like, no, it's just, I had a shitty day. You know, my cat peed in my shoe. My girlfriend broke up with me and my mom just was a, you know, an asshole on the telephone. Normal day. I find that more than stigmatism and fear, it is almost a thing, like every bad thing that every bad day I'm having, or every adverse reaction I'm having, or every time I lose my patience and pop off on you, that's more attributed to the illness than it is just, no, I'm human. I lost my patience. And, you know, that's both sides. That is more than getting benefits. That is what people who suffer from different neural atypical behaviors, that's where they use the crutch, I find most. They honestly just do some shitty things. It's like, that was just shitty. It's like, oh, but it was I've done it, you know, growing up. It's very, it's like, if my entire life is going to be blamed on this, then this one time I do something that's like really shit. Oh, the depression. And it's like, no, you're just really, you're being inconsiderate is what you were doing. That's not depression. That's inconsiderate. That's a lot of work for, you know, that's the work that we as people that have these things have to really deal with, is like, what are we giving ourselves? You know, what are we, radical forgiveness is a very important part of this. And it's the ability to really truly forgive yourself for things that you need to forgive yourself for. The other side of that is also, it's like, personal responsibility. It's like, oof, you know, did I let myself off the hook a little too easily because in the name of mental illness? It's a hard road to navigate, and you go both ways, you know? And I guess that's the third and final myth on this, is that you're not healed from mental, and that's where this is a lifelong thing. And it comes and goes and you get better at it and stuff like that. But you're never going to cross the finish line, and you got to just continually evaluate and keep yourself to task and be honest with, you know, loving but honest simultaneously. And I think that's what we ask for our loved ones. Even sometimes we don't want it. Sometimes I've gotten some real honesty, and it's like, yeah, you know, a few months later, it's like, yeah, I really needed that.
Gotcha.
And that's just like anything else. You know, it's like, if you know, have a friend that's got a weight control problem, and they're always, I have problems with my weight and I'm running out of breath and blah, blah, blah. And then you walk into the break room and they got a freaking buffet going on. You know, you gotta, you know, if you're a true friend, it's like, look, dude, I know this is important to you and I know you struggle with this, but maybe not that many calories at 10 a.m.
And I'm going to wind up with one more kind of topic that has become almost, I want to say, fashionable to talk about, but I know that there might be some real science behind it. Mm-hmm. Then that's people that are taking acid to control their episodes. What is behind that? Is it real, or is it just folks that want to take a nice long strange trip?
We don't know. A full disclosure, I have been microdosing for about 2 years, and it has changed my life. But
okay.
The problem is, we don't have the science yet. We have good preliminary science. We have lots of anecdotal science. It does seem to help for people who are older and who have proven to be medically resistant. It also, when we define microdose, we're talking about 1/10 of a potent effect. So whatever, you know, like a standard hit of acid, a recreational hit of acid would be 1/10 of that twice a week. So you're not talking about people getting crazy. That seems to be the standard treatment, is 2 days off for every 1 day on. Other places are leading the science. We had a, you know, in the United States in the late 60s, early 70s, Nixon made a lot of the drugs of the counterculture. I believe it's, you know, class A or class one narcotic. But anyway, that it is illegal, has no use other than recreation. I pressured most of the world to go along with that determination. Two of those drugs were marijuana and psilocybin or LSD. They're kind of put in the same box. Psilocybin is what's found in magic mushrooms, which seems to be the most promising. But there was all this research in the box, And now the research that was pulled out was, you know, like CIA projects where they're just like heavily, you know, dosing people. And anything in a large amount is going to not be great for you, you know, and that's what getting messed up is kind of about, you know, a drink of alcohol, not so much. A case, yeah, you're going to have some effects. Same thing with the chemicals in LSD or psilocybin or, you know, even THC. It's like, yeah, if you're Cheech and Chong in it or Timothy Leary just, you know, papering the entire bottom of your lip, yeah, that's not what it's about. But therapeutically, we're seeing really good results from places in Europe and England. Canada's even taking a little lead on this. They haven't legalized it, but they're not pursuing anything with psilocybin in Canada. Like, you can buy it online, measure it out exactly, just microdoses and little capsules in Canada now. There are three now, I think, in the United States, two in Colorado, one in California, cities that have decriminalized it. But the problem is with the lack of concerted science and with the lack of control groups, this thing exists between science and Joe Rogan. You don't want therapeutic things to live there, you know? And so you do meet microdosers out there. You do see microdosers out there just like, oh, it's what I do. And it's like, you know, you're taking a 20% hit every day, and that's not the thing. And the other people's like, well, it's a drug, you know? And let's put it this way. It is so promising at the moment, especially psilocybin, that I believe it was North Carolina, University of North Carolina or Duke have genetically modified yeast bacteria, like bacteria, where their waste byproduct is psilocybin. So we can get a pure thing of psilocybin than trying to find it in a plant where it varies in strength amongst each plant and amongst each place in the plant. It's what makes precise medical microdosing with psilocybin hard outside of like taking 50 plants, grinding them, and then dividing the dust. I can tell from an anecdotal level that after years of being medically resistant to stuff, that really focusing my medical treatments on ADHD and using this therapeutic approach to deal with my depression, as I have many years dealing with depression, I know my warning signs. I am in consultation with a medical professional who obviously won't be named, but to make sure this is all going well, it's great. And it has actually kind of turned my life around the last couple of years. I just wish it could come out into the light and really talk about it, because, and it gets weird. I mean, we saw ketamine as a rescue drug for really violent depressive episodes. And ketamine is more effective than any other standard treatments for about 2 weeks. And about 2 weeks peaks out, but it takes you out of that death valley, right? So then the United States gets on board with it. And now like a $10, you know, what was called Special K in the 90s at raves. This is now $100 and $200 treatment under medical supervision, which is like, well, thanks. And now we're seeing police officers like hitting some kid with 10 doses of ketamine because they think he's out of control. And the fact was he like had some mental problems and the kid died. So it's like, whenever any treatment comes into the United States, it's just a shit show. And it's just like, no, ketamine should not be in the field with police officers to administer as a sedative. It should not. It should only be as a sedative, it should only be administered by a medical professional, hopefully in a psychiatric emergency room. At the same time, it's like, it just frustrates me. It frustrates me that we put good science in the file cabinet somewhere around 1965 and haven't moved on it, even though all the results seem fairly promising. There's good science behind it. There's good CAT scans behind it. There is a good scientific reason it works, especially compared to, you know, some of your bipolar drugs and some of your heavy antidepressant drugs were, you know, well, we had this anti-convulsion medicine that didn't work for convulsions, but seemed to make people less depressed. That's Lamictal. That drug was developed for something else. And it's like, but it seemed to help with this. And it's like, okay, a lot of the stuff, because that's the way it is, there's one thing that's never talked about in American psychiatry right now is if someone gives you a prescription, and a lot of times it's like, well, what have you had before? What's worked for you? What did you like? What didn't you like? Have you tried this? I mean, it's really like being in a college dorm room. It's like, well, you know, let's be a little bit more targeted. And there's never the thing about, okay, what is the treatment plan? What's the course of treatment? When's the check back in? What's the plan to get off this shit? If you have to be on it forever and there's a good reason for it and the side effects aren't as bad as the main thing, which Gary Gary Gollum, a comedian, talks about, you know, oh, impotence. Yeah. Because I was having so much sex when I was in a fetal position on my couch. You know, to him, it's like being on this for the rest of his life makes sense. Mm-hmm. But there's so many people that once, you know, especially young, they went through a depressive trough. It could have been a lot of things attributed to that. What's the check-in point? When do we gradually wean them off to see where it's at? And that's why we have problems, I think, long-term care in the mental health community, is because these things are just thrown at you. You're on them. There's not a plan to get off. So people's determination and stick-to-itiveness and trying to really stay with a course of therapy eventually wanes, just because it just seems like we're not, you know, you can't test levels. You know, it's just like, well, I don't seem to be as depressed. When I had to, about two and a half years ago, I had a complete neuropsych evaluation and just went down to just medicine to treat my ADHD, which meant I had to go off stuff that they had had me on, because I mean, I was like a gross, I was like the greatest. You could tell, it's like, oh, this drug was really popular that year. That drug was really popular that year. More to do with pharmaceutical salesmen than science. You know, it's like, I was the hit list of all of them. And going off that stuff was terrible. It was absolutely terrible. It was not fun. And, but we were at a point where I was with it in my system wasn't fun and not helpful. And it was counter, that medicine was counterindicative to the ADHD medicine. You couldn't take both at once. So it was like, I was in a awful place. I had to go to a worse place in order to get to a better place. And it's, the management of it is just silly. And that allows people like the Joe Rogans and things like that to see something interesting out there. And it makes it easier for snake oil salesmen. You know, when there's so much confusion and so much bad experience, someone could come up and like, hey, you know, just, you know, eating a couple mushroom caps, you know, and not really getting into the science and the dosage. And, you know, it just, I see where it is attractive. I mean, even as someone who's benefited from it, I'm still like, you know, definitely not under the age of 30. And, you know, make, you know, there are definitely steps to go before the science is set. Yeah, we don't know. And it's because you have a stigmatized method of treatment within a field of health that carries stigmas too, you know? Why do we want someone with anxiety or depression tripping balls? That just seems like a recipe for disaster. And it's like, well, that's not what we're talking about. But it doesn't get any attention. I mean, because pharmaceutical companies aren't rushing to it because they got a lot of products out there. The nation's attention isn't on it. We lack serious patient advocacy groups in this country. People who have a loud gong for the people in the waiting rooms. There are mental health advocates in this country, but they are drowned out by so many other things. And they're generally not put on camera until someone shoots up a school, which has very little to do with the problem we're having. Soapbox.
Quite all right. Well, speaking of soapboxes, you're a verbal artist of a type. So I'd like you to tell us a little bit about where people can learn more about your speaking, your writing.
We call it a voice artist. Verbal artist isn't bad. Okay. I'm glad you didn't call it an oral artist, because that would have gotten weird. I'm at themadbastard.com. I think actually when I met you, I was doing a storytelling series I did all over the country about kind of growing up undiagnosed and just kind of how weird and funny and sometimes sad it is. I mean, it's kind of, you know, very funny parts, very not funny parts. And it never existed in a format other than audio scripts, because they were always public readings. I never really shaped it into a book because it didn't really fit there. So I just decided during the pandemic to find those scripts and scan them and kind of go over them. And I've started re-releasing them. I believe I have right now about 4 chapters up. It's a 10-chapter book. And so by the end of this month, I should have them all up and recorded. Now I got my new booth. So you can go to, themadbastard.com and download and listen to those free, absolutely free. And I occasionally have some articles there, and it's just kind of a launching point for whatever the hell I'm going to do after this damn pandemic is over. And then occasionally I'm in the Leo writing about social justice stuff. So, and you know, if you have a moment, check Zero Campaign. Especially they have a 4-part podcast about the untold story of policing, which especially people in the Louisville area, the police contract that's up for negotiation right now may be one of the best things we can do to get justice for Breonna Taylor, is just change the relationship between the community and the police in a positive way. So that's kind of where my, because once again, it may seem weird to, oh, everyone's just always shoehorning policing into this, you know, because it's very, when you talk about dangers for, you know, what's dangerous to people with mental health and undiagnosed mental health, a police interaction is incredibly, can be dangerous for people who are having a bad mental health day. You know, there's suicide by cops where people just charge them. And there's also just people that are having a bad day. They're out of their head. The really, the ability to understand or comply or behave, that's not at the top of the shelf. And a lot of our officers only have about 16 to 20 hours period overall of how to recognize that and deal with it, which isn't enough. So we need to get this contract changed for everybody's good, for all, for, you know, Black lives that matter. And those things that happen that allow Black lives matter to matter also just drills down and helps all sorts of people, including people dealing with mental health problems.
Well, JP,
like in soapbox.
Always welcome. JP, thank you so much for coming on Unsensitive and sharing not only your story, but your points of view and your knowledge on mental health and the stigmas surrounding it. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on here. And I've enjoyed watching your cat and, you know, a new, I knew you when, Ray, and now you are. Now you have a popular, profitable podcast, so I'm jealous.
We shall see if it continues that way.
All right. But after this episode, it won't.
Okay. <All right. laughs> On that note, speaking of which, I have a challenge to everybody that has been listening. If you have a topic that you are passionate about and you want to bring it on here and defend it, tell us more about it and educate folks that may not want to listen, but they might, if they hear the questions that they would want to ask, but don't feel like they could actually ask you, please reach out to me, rayrobwrites@gmail.com. You can also reach us through the Fearscape Media Network, where you can find anywhere on most of your favorite streaming platforms for podcasts, as well as Facebook. You can find the groups there for both Unsensitive and the Fearscape Media Network and its partner podcasts. So thank you very much. Also to Ben Sounds for the intro and outro music. Thank you so much for listening to Unsensitive, and remember, keep your mind open, not so open that it falls out, but hopefully open enough. Thank you so much.